Some are dubbing 2016 the worst year ever. Whether or not you agree with that assessment, the new year is right around the corner. That's why we'll explore some of the year's most important stories during today's Behind the Headlines. I'm your host, Katie O'Connell. Thanks so much for tuning in. Milwaukee made national headlines in August following 2 days of unrest in the Sherman Park neighborhood. The unrest came after the shooting death of Seville Smith by former Milwaukee police officer Dominique Hagan Brown. But the tension between police and residents of Sherman Park was at a boiling point prior to the shooting. Crime reporter Ashley Luthern was at Sherman Park the night of the unrest. She sat down with fellow crime reporter Gina Barton to discuss what happened that night and what's happened in the months since.
The national problems of police shootings and race relations really hit home in Milwaukee in August when riots broke out in the Sherman Park neighborhood. Reporter Ashley Luthern and I were among more than a dozen in our newsroom who covered the unrest and its aftermath. For those who might not remember the details, Ashley, why don't you talk a little bit about the shooting that sparked that riot?
Sure, Gina. So at about 3:30 p.m. on a Saturday in August, two police officers stopped their squad car. They saw a parked rental car that they thought was suspicious. The driver, later identified as Seville Smith, fled. We were told initial information was that Smith fled with a gun, and he was shot twice by Officer Dominique Hagan Brown, who is now a former officer.
You went out to Sherman Park that night. What was going on?
I was called by an editor in our newsroom about 8:30 that night because one of our interns, actually two of our interns, were out there, one a photographer and one a reporter, and they said the scene was getting kind of tense and that a car was being rocked back and forth at that point in time. The editor called me because I have since I've been covering this beat, I kind of know the key players. I might be able to identify people more readily in terms of officials or community leaders, that sort of thing. So not knowing much, I headed out there. Before I did, I checked social media channels, and I was a little surprised to see that there wasn't any TV coverage at that particular moment. Checked all my fellow reporters that I know from other outlets, and nothing really prepared me for what I saw, which was just a crush of people, so many people around 44th and Hour and Sherman Park. And I parked my car, I think, on 42nd. I got out. There were tons of people milling around. I got out to Sherman Boulevard in that grassy area there, and there were huge crowds. They were not friendly. They were not friendly towards media. It was very clear that my presence was perhaps exacerbating the situation. I saw a car that was on fire, and was basically told that I should leave by people who were at the park. And I clearly felt like I wouldn't be able to get any answers. I identified myself. I tried asking some questions. People were not in the mood to talk. And I understand that. I understand that given, historical context with media and whatnot. And it was just a really volatile situation. So I left. I was able to go and pick up our intern reporter who had been jumped. Multiple other media outlets also were reported experiencing things like being threatened. They themselves were jumped. I know at least one TV station, maybe two, had cameras stolen that night. So it was a very tense setting. So I was probably out on the ground only about 15 minutes, and then I came back to the newsroom.
It sounds pretty scary. I mean, I wasn't even there, and I found the whole thing scary.
It is the only time that I've actually felt a little bit in danger for my safety while reporting. We got back to the newsroom. I started adding some context to the existing story that was out there. At midnight, I went out with another reporter, Rick Rommel, who had come in to help out. And we went to a news conference with the mayor and one of the assistant police chiefs, as well as the president, Common Council president, and other Common Council members. And I think at that point, things were still unfolding. By that moment, buildings were on fire. And the fire department couldn't get to the buildings to treat them for quite a while because gunshots were flying.
And what was the extent of the damage that we were able to figure out after it was all over?
Oh, man. Authorities like the ATF and Milwaukee Police Department put the damage estimates at several millions of dollars. At least, I believe, 8 buildings sustained fire damage. At least 2 people were wounded in shootings during those 2 nights. You know, officers were injured with debris, bricks being thrown through their windows. Multiple squad cars were damaged or windows were broken in them. And so that's, you know, there were a lot of things unfolding.
And really, nothing like this has been seen in Milwaukee in recent history, right?
No. The only thing people could compare it to were, like, the riots in the 60s.
In the week that followed, you had an idea for a big picture story that you and I worked on together. So where did you get the idea for that story? And what was some of the context that you felt it was important that we write about?
So I think even the first night of the unrest, you really already saw people on social media online being like, oh, I'm not necessarily surprised it's happened in Milwaukee. Milwaukee has all these really stark racial disparities, whether it's in geographic segregation or economic differences in economic opportunity or educational attainment. And so I think it's important to always put our stories in context. And, you know, what happened in Sherman Park didn't happen in a vacuum. There was, you know, some immediate precursors, obviously a police shooting. There was some, you know, tension leading up that summer with, you know, different businesses and folks in the park and young people in the park that we had to explore. But then there was this bigger context of, you know, what is going on in Milwaukee? And I think that was something you also felt strongly that we should report. And not only what's going on in Milwaukee in terms of, you know, disparities that we see day in and day out, but also what is that history when it comes to policing in Milwaukee? And I think that's a story, being a local news outlet, we were in the best position to tell.
And I mean, I think that initially people were left asking, well, it's a black officer, it's a black civilian. Why would this cause a riot? All this racial tension all this time in Milwaukee, why is the one that kind of puts everything over the edge, the one that doesn't really have a racial element to it?
I think that's something that a lot of people are asking. And as we said, pretty upfront in the story, how you phrase that question or how you answer that question often depended on your race. What are your thoughts on that?
I think it just continues to show the disconnect both about what's going on in people's lives depending on their race and their socioeconomic status and where they live. I also think it shows a disconnect between how those different groups view the police and police shootings in general.
I think I would also note a lot of the early tension also seemed to be because both the officer and the man who was shot and killed were well known in the neighborhood. I mean, so you had kind of all these immediate factors too. It was a Saturday afternoon. A lot of people saw it or were in the immediate area of when it happened. It was in the summer. It was warm. A lot of people could stay and gather at the scene. And then you kind of had this extra layer where, you know, on one hand, Wisconsin's very proud of the fact it has this state law about how you investigate officer-involved deaths. Milwaukee, at that point, was using state agents to, you know, lead their investigations. Those state agents had to travel in. That led to a delay of a couple hours before, you know, the body could be removed. And so that's just allowing this tension to build and build and build and more people to come.
All these months later, the story has not gone away. So why don't you catch people up to recent developments?
The shooting happened in mid-August. The first major development came in October when the officer involved, Dominique Hagen-Brown, was charged with sexual assault and several misdemeanor counts of prostitution. He was criminally charged and arrested. And 2 weeks after that, he was fired from the department for that kind of conduct. And then within the past week, he also now has been charged with first-degree reckless homicide with the fatal shooting of Sylvia Smith.
Do you think that those homicide charges are going to do anything to improve police community relations or to give these types of investigations more legitimacy in the future?
I think it will, because often you hear in Milwaukee and in other places all around the country, all people want is for a case to go before a judge or a jury. They just want all of the facts and information out there. In many ways, you hear you know, you hear this refrain that if someone else had killed my loved one, they would at least have a trial. There would at least be some sort of public reckoning, if you will, of what happened and why and who's at fault and how can we prevent it from happening in the future.
Thank you, Ashley and Gina, for that segment. To find more of their coverage on Sherman Park, visit jsonline.com. Before I get into this next segment, I want to reassure you that we will have some lighter fare in today's show. But it wouldn't be a recap of 2016 unless we talked about this year's election. Who walked away from the election with a victory belt, and who needs to regroup with their team? Some answers to that question are more obvious than others. Editor Greg Borowski got the scoop from columnist Daniel Bice and reporter Bill Glauber in the final episode of JS on Politics this year.
So, Dana, here's one of the trade-off questions for you. Whose star was on the rise after Huerta?
I think, obviously, Reince Priebus is on the rise. Ron Johnson's on the rise. Locally, Chris Abele is on the rise. Won re-election, did very well this year.
And let me just interject. Congressman Sean Duffy, outstate, out of Wausau, on the rise.
All right. And, Bill, whose star is falling at this point?
Well, I covered it. Russ Feingold, the former U.S. senator who lost in his bid to get back to the U.S. Senate. Alderman Bob Donovan, who ran, by all accounts, just not a very good mayoral campaign.
And now is being, you know, called out by the head of the Common Council, Ashanti Hamilton, on stuff. I mean, yeah.
The guy who, that was that coalition we talked about.
Right, the now non-existent Ashanti coalition. And then state Democrats in general.
And they were losers, obviously. They lost an assembly seat that nobody even knew that they could possibly lose. And then State Senator Jen Schilling, the leader of the minority Democrats in the state Senate, won her race against Dan Kopanky by a handful of votes. And I mean, you could put them in your hands. Yeah. That's how close it was.
All right. So, Dan, the question here is, who responded best to a crisis? Or is that claim, you know, don't ever let a good crisis go to waste? So who didn't let a good crisis go to waste?
I mean, there are two that come to mind. I think Ron Johnson had his own personal crisis where it looked like there was no way he was going to win.
He was left for dead.
And in August, he turns it around and ends up winning. And then secondly, I think local officials in response to the Sherman Park riot, I mean, which was a riot, that didn't blow up and they were able to bring it under control. And I think that the sheriff's office...
It blew up, but they were, you know, in all seriousness, this was a two-day, two-night, you know,
right.
Terrible situation.
It had the potential, had the potential to go on for weeks.
And it didn't. And in the meantime, since then, of course, they've leveled charges against the police officer involved in the shooting.
It's been slow and methodical, but very effective, I think.
Yeah. All right. And, Bill, who, in your mind, responded worst to a crisis?
Well, that would be the biggest loser of the political year, Hillary Clinton, who was the Democratic nominee for president, was one of the worst candidates of modern history. I would put her with Michael Dukakis and perhaps even Tom Dewey back in 1948 against Harry Truman. At every juncture of that campaign, when she needed to go big, she didn't. It was terrible.
And we now know that the Clinton campaign was aware that there was trouble in Wisconsin, but they didn't come here. Hillary didn't come here. Hillary Clinton didn't come here from April. It has not been here since April, the April election. And decided not to come here because they thought it would demonstrate some sort of weakness locally.
And I know Democrats will be upset with us saying this, and you know it is the reality. And you know what we did see this year were the deaths of two political dynasties, the Clinton dynasty and the Bush dynasty. Even though there's a younger Bush in Texas.
Let me go with one more here before we try to get a viewer question or two. And so, whose 15 minutes of fame is over?
Rona Swanigan, who ran for district attorney, lots of attention, more than $500,000 spent trying to get her elected locally, gone. And there's talk that she might want to run for judge, but I think her career is over.
To find more of our political coverage from 2016, visit jsonline.com/politics. I'd also suggest subscribing to our JS on Politics podcast so you can stay in the loop for 2017. That's available on Audioboom, iTunes, and Stitcher Radio. Our political reporters weren't the only ones who were busy covering this year's election. Our editorial team needed to address it as well. So how did they handle their coverage of the extremely contentious presidential election, among others? That answer comes from a segment we aired previously this year. Here's editorial editors Dave Haynes and Ernie Franzen with more.
Hi, this is David Haynes. I'm the opinions editor at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, and I'm with
Ernie Franzen, the associate editorial page editor.
And we thought we'd talk for a minute or two today about sort of the aftermath of the most divisive election that I can ever remember. I don't know about you, Ernie. What do you think?
Yeah, probably. I mean, obviously, in the 60s, when I was a young lad, it was a very divisive time, but the elections weren't quite as close or quite as divisive. So.
Well, you also covered the Civil War, too.
Well, right? The Civil War was rough, but no,
we're kidding.
No, we're not.
But no, it was incredibly divisive. And our role as opinion journalists who run a forum both on the printed page and, of course, at our website and on mobile devices now, our role is to create that forum. We have tools that we can use to help people think about issues. One of those is the editorial. We write columns. But what we really do, our mission, is to provide that place where people can come and have a conversation in a civil way. That's been harder for all of us, I think. Boy, if you were on Twitter in the last few days, I don't know if you spent much time on Twitter, but
yeah, it's been very sharp-edged opinions on both sides.
Yeah.
Now, I want to add, we do this, what Dave is talking about, in our op-eds, but also in our letters pages. If you looked at our letters pages, for example, last Sunday, we had letters on both sides of the presidential candidates, on the Senate mm-hmm. race, a couple or at least one for Gary Johnson. And we've done that through the week where we had letters from Trump supporters who were glad he won and people who think this is the end of the world. So we're trying to promote that forum on the op-ed page with op-eds through our editorials and through letters to the editors.
Yeah, we really want to hear from people on right. both sides, people who voted for Hillary Clinton, people who voted for Donald Trump. There are limits. There always are. That's why we're editors. We're not going to let people call each other names. We're never going to use some screed from a white nationalist, for example, or something like that. But we do want to hear from thoughtful people on both sides because there are a lot of thoughtful people on both sides. And I heard from some of them, too, quite a few of them, actually, this week.
Sure. And I did, too. There are people I was surprised would support Trump, but they did, and they did for reasons that had nothing to do with his misogyny or his race baiting, but because they were unhappy with Clinton, and felt he would do better on the economy, especially. So that's where they're coming from.
I mean, and I understand that. I've talked to a number of people who felt that way. I have to say, personally, I find it hard to understand how people could overlook right. Trump's flaws, but Clinton had her flaws too, I guess, and that's where they were coming from.
And I think those people think that a lot of that was just talk and a lot of that was just an attempt to garner a vote and that he will do better in office, and we can only hope that that's the case.
Yeah, there's this great quote in The Atlantic about Trump that I think, and the media, that I think was accurate. Let's see if I can get it right. The author said that the media takes Trump literally, but not seriously. Trump's supporters right. take him seriously, but not literally. And I think that in some ways tells you about what you need to know about Trump supporters.
Right. And the Trump supporters I talked to, abhor what he said in many cases. And yet they were willing to get beyond that to what they think is a guy better able to handle things like the economy.
Yeah. Well, so once again, what we want in our forums, on our op-ed page, on our letters page, in everything we do online, on Facebook, on Twitter, we want to hear from everybody. We run a forum irrespective of partisanship. So we'd like to hear from people on both sides. So, again, this is David Haynes with the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. I'm the opinions editor, and
Ernie Franzen, the associate opinions editor.
All right. Till next time.
Thanks. Appreciate it.
Bye.
If you're interested in reading more of Dave and Ernie's work, you can find it at jsonline.com/opinion. And if you'd like to write a letter to the editor, which we always encourage, you'll find instructions on how to do so online as well. As promised, here's our lighter fare to close out the show. It's been a big year for beer in Milwaukee, with a number of new breweries opening, others expanding, and plans for even more next year. Beer writer Kathy Flanagan sat down with Chelsea Lewis to talk about the new brews in town and what beer lovers have to look forward to in 2017.
2016 was a really good year for beer lovers in Milwaukee.
Oh my gosh. Yes, their beer ship came in.
Yes, yes. So how many new breweries have we had?
Okay, if you're just counting sort of Milwaukee kind of proper, I have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8.
Wow, 8.
So 8. Fermentorium, which is in Cedarburg, so not proper.
Yeah, we'll consider it.
Good City, Urban Harvest, Mobcraft, Black Husky, Bavarian Beer House, which is in Glendale, and Third Space and Lake Mines.
Wow.
That is not including Benjamin Beer and Racine, Arnoggin and Kenosha. And then some switcheroos within breweries that were in place. So Enlighten moved to the first floor at the Lincoln Warehouse, and Eagle Park Brewing moved in. So they're a new brewery. And then Sweet Mullet's got a new owner, so sort of breathed new life into that brewery. And Biloba expected to open in their new brewery, bigger tap room and brewery, this month, but they had sort of a setback this week. So, for sure in January.
And that's just the past year. I mean, before that,
2016.
In 2015, 2014, we had a smattering of openings as well. So, it's like the beer boom is happening in Milwaukee.
Oh, my gosh.
It's exciting.
It will continue into 2017.
So, what else do we have to look forward to in 2017?
Okay. So, in 2017, January, Explorium will open at Southridge. And that should be really fun. City Lights, I think, will probably open in January.
Okay. I was going to ask you about City Lights because I think we've all been wondering when City Lights is going to open. And they promised us the summer,
and then
it was the fall,
now
it's January. Okay.
You know, their building is really old.
Yeah.
And
sure.
I think they didn't realize they were going to have to do supports in it to hold up the equipment because it's a really old building mm-hmm. and it's very sturdy. And I think nobody cared that it was sturdy, that the government said, no, you must do it this way.
Sure.
So they've had some setbacks, but their brewing equipment came in earlier this month. This month. So I think they're getting ready,
cool.
And I assume
now you
it will
got
be January.
Kind of like a private tour of that a while back, right?
Mm-hmm.
So it's looking like it's going to be a cool space.
Oh, my gosh, it's beautiful. I mean, the building is beautiful from the outside, but the ideas they have for it are great, and it's history. I mean, there's this tower, and the tower won't be ready for public for a while. But, I mean, it just goes up and up and up, and it's just cool.
That's awesome.
It's all like spelunking.
Urban spelunking.
Yes.
I love it. Nice. Maybe not while you're drinking a beer, but
no.
You can admire from the safety of a chair.
Actually, when I went, it's been like at the beginning of the summer, and so I went up all the stairs that go to the top, and as I got there, I heard a thunk, and birds were like running into the window
oh my God.
Getting in. So they've fixed it up, and it's much nicer now.
That's awesome. So in addition to some new beers you can see on taps around town, a few of these breweries are offering tours too, right? What new tours are there around town?
Good City has a tour on, I want to say Saturdays. I should have wrote it.
I think that sounds right. Yeah.
Mobcraft has tours on Saturdays, and Third Space is giving tours on Saturdays and Sundays.
Cool.
So, and Urban Harvest also has tours once a month, usually on a Saturday, but you have to check their Facebook page to make sure.
Oh, Awesome.
They all have beer as part of the tour. I think the price runs from $5 to $12. So, I'm writing a story about tours, so people have a whole list to take with them between Christmas and New Year's or any time. But when, you know, you have relatives in and you don't know what to do, that you can make a day of that. You make a weekend of that.
Could make a month of that.
And then next year you could make a week of it.
Yeah, that's great. With more new breweries, more local beer, have you also noticed that more bars are serving good beer in addition to local beer, but just like good craft beer in general?
Oh my gosh, yes. And part of that is maybe I can't get to every bar because, you know, I have a liver. But
or you want to still have a
liver. I would like to still have my liver.
It's important.
As big as it is now. So like Karma has a great beer menu that I didn't recognize before. I think a lot of smaller bars have just gotten into the habit of having craft beer because that's what people like to drink. It still doesn't outsell the bigger beers,
sure.
But people really seem to like it, and it's growing in leaps and bounds.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I know when I walk into a bar these days, if I don't see at least a couple of good craft offerings, I'm like, what? Nah, we're out of here.
Yeah, I mean, it doesn't matter. It could be a dive bar. As long as they have craft beer, I can hang out there. You know, it's just, it makes sense. People want it. They're used to drinking it. Mm-hmm. And if they can't get it there, they can go to the brewery, which, you know, that may pose some issue for some bars, but smart bars have a lot of variety of beers.
Yes.
And breweries have their own beers. So I think the two can play together well.
Absolutely. Yeah. Cool. So what other trends or things are happening or do you see happening in the next year?
Well, I mean, I think we'll see more breweries. I mean, like, coming next year is Venture, the brewery that's going to do coffee and beer.
Ooh,
and I think they have their space. I know. And they're going to be, like, 1 mile from my house.
Nice.
I think they have their space picked out in Wauwatosa. So I don't know next steps are, but they're closing in. Broken Bat, which you can, if you're in the Third Ward, you can see their progress. You just peer down in the window. They've just started a Kickstarter to kind of move things along so they can be open in time for baseball season. West Allian is getting closer in West Dallas. I went to a beer class the other night, and a guy I was sitting next to expects to start his own brewery in West Dallas. By next year. I mean, it's just, it's crazy. Everybody and the guy next to you at the table are opening their brewery. So by next year, we should have Gathering Place in River West. And then at the other table at this event, there's a guy who's involved with the brewery in Mequon. So, I mean,
wow.
And then Milwaukee Brewing will have their new brewery at Pabst Place. And I don't know what's going on with Pabst. They were supposed to be open by now, but they're not. But Milwaukee Brewing, I'm sure, will be on schedule with their new showroom, shall we say, at the Pabst Complex.
Yeah, that's an embarrassment of riches for beer lovers.
Oh, my gosh, it's going to be great. I mean, yes, this is why my liver is expanding on a daily basis, exactly.
Follow along with Kathy's beer writing at tapmilwaukee.com. And if you want to swing by new breweries across the state, we've got an easy way for you to find them. Simply visit jsonline.com/beernear. That does it with our year-end recap. Thanks so much for listening, and best of luck in 2017. I'm your host, Katie O'Connell, wishing you a happy new year from everyone here at the Journal Sentinel. We look forward to connecting with you more next year.